Where's Harry? Even extra time, partially because he was running behind. Oh, Harry. Man, this is like the show notes are so thick. And I'll mention Harry too, but if we don't get to all of it, then we'll just do a part two next week or something. You know, like there's just no way to do this much detail. I mean, if we did 90 minutes or 2 hours of this much detail, people's heads would spin. So,
well, it'd be like the first couple Loki walls where we ran for 4 hours.
Yeah, I don't have that kind of energy anymore.
I don't today. I don't think I can do that today. This has been a long day.
My God, Harry. Oh, Harry. Oh, Harry. Oh, Harry.
You would think you'd be on time, you know, since we have to drive in.
Yeah. But see, that's like the thing. It's harder when it's just like you're at your house, you're doing things, you don't have to be somewhere, and then you look up and you're like, oh, shit. That's happened to me a couple times. That happened once with the League of Liberty.
And that's why it's all gone to hell. It's all my fault. One time.
Nobody intimated that it was my fault, but I think everybody, because Roger said that it was because co-host on some podcast, Roger said that the League of Liberty is dead because co-hosts were late and didn't show up. Because Roger said it, I think people automatically assume me, but it's like, I was only a few minutes late once. Mm-hmm. So, and then I was late again once because we were waiting on Roger and he never showed, but it's not just that. It's like, it became as, and there's no animosity there or anything for you patrons. It literally was just like, as our networks grew and our lives changed and our responsibilities got harder, it's like, how many co-hosts have we had here on We Are Libertarians? You know, and it's because people get married, like Joe Ruiz has another kid and he's doing the rap thing. His interest changed. Like, there's no beef between me and Joe Ruiz, but, you know, he needed to do something different. And so, you know, like Greg, his interest changed. that one was a little more complicated. But for the most part, it's just like, you know, Gina just got tired of coming every week, you know, and Harry is the trooper. He's the one who's been around almost the longest at this point. But, Yeah, so it just got harder and harder to schedule those things because you've got four busier and busier and busier people. And so it just was like, finally, it's just too much.
Partially from the success that you guys were having.
Yeah, I mean, it really did work from the beginning 3 years ago when we kind of set all that up because – the history was we had been talking to Being Libertarian. It was under different management, and they wanted, like, all the rights to our shows. And we were like, hell no. Why don't we just promote each other and do, like, a Super Friends podcast? And, you know, I'm the one that invited Roger in, which I eventually regretted. But I felt we needed a fourth person with, like, a more hardcore bent, you know, and Roger.
He is that.
Yep. Exactly, and Roger and I were very close friends at the time. Now, after all his betrayals, I just can't. No, so it's no animosity or anything. There's no breakup or anything there. It's just got harder and harder to schedule that stuff. And finally, Mark was the one carrying the torch. Like, hey, do we want to do this? Do we want to do this? And it was just like after the last one fell apart, and it was just impossible to set up. I was just like, I PM'd him. I was like, dude. You've done yeoman's work. You don't have to do this anymore. Like, if it's dead, it's dead. Let's move on. So, and he and I briefly talked about doing something, but I just didn't have time to get it going. Like, I'm just struggling to get my own show done and get the other two podcasts done and get my job done. And so, at a quality that I want to do it at. And the idea that he and I had was really, like, it would be a lot of homework, and this already is a lot of homework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... So that's just kind of that. So if any of you heard, you know, I heard a few people kind of go, well, what actually happened with Illegal Liberty? It's like, not much. Just everybody got successful. Yeah.
Life happened, as with everything.
Yep. It is hard. It's the same with, like, you have a 3 to 4 year window for volunteers in the Libertarian Party. And then they go away because their kid goes back to college or there's just some excuse why it changes. So,
yeah.
Well, I don't know. Should we just start without him?
Has he responded or anything to any pings?
Well, I sent him the thing. And we texted like an hour ago.
He's probably having a minor emergency at home. Wait a minute.
I'll send him like a shitty note.
I see something logging in.
Something bubbling. Oh, yep, that's probably him.
Something was bubbling over there.
Did you have diarrhea? So this, okay? I won't say this on the big show, but because we're trying to clean it up. But so I go to work out on... yesterday, Monday. So I go to work out, and I had gotten this new new hydration stuff. So in the pre-workout, I put the hydration stuff in there. I'm like, all right, I want to be hydrated, so I'll put this in here. Mm-hmm. And then I had my normal Propel stick in the water bottle during the workout. And then I was like, you know, I better put some of the post in the post-workout, so I put some more of that in there. So I had about... and then I got home. I wasn't feeling great, so I took 2 emergency packets.
Okay.
And all hell broke loose because of the magnesium. You really need to turn yourself up, Harry.
The mic is like, I'm here.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm really using this mic. I apologize.
So in an effort to hydrate myself, I gave myself the most dehydrating function you could have, which is diarrhea. And I am just like, and the special someone was over last night, and I'm like, I'm so sorry. This is not attractive, but I had too much pre-workout and post-workout. I'm too much of an athlete, too much magnesium. It irritates your bowels. And so I was just in hell. So, you know, and I don't want to dehydrate myself. The whole point was to hydrate myself.
Yeah, aggressively.
Yes. So I go over to the little medicine stack, and I go, all right, well, I'll find the Imodium. So I pop 2 Imodiums, and I'm like, you know, that didn't feel right. Like, it felt too big. So I scrounge around in there, and I go, oh, here's the Imodium. I just took 2 water pills. I had some, like, diuretics from when I tried keto, and I was just getting holding on to too much water, and so I took 2 diuretics. So I had it coming out of both ends. So then I took the Imodium. So that kind of then I was constipated this morning. So I dehydrated and I woke up with the worst headache. So I was super dehydrated. Dumb.
And you can get this on premium Snapchat with Chris Fix.
Yeah,
Chris Fix.
Good time to send in a message because I'm was shitting my brains out.
So we're gonna talk about Elizabeth Warren tonight, right? We're not gonna talk about all the fun stuff that's going to happen tomorrow.
What's happening?
Live hearings.
Yeah.
Start tomorrow.
No, this I don't know how deep you guys went on the Warren stuff, but this is red meat for libertarians. This is just like stunningly ridiculous.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, we'll get into it. I don't get into that too much, but there's just a lot of other fun stuff going on too that it's going to be interesting. We could get into libertarian stuff that's going on, Libertarian Party stuff.
I could give a shit.
For the premium guys here.
Yeah, I could give a shit. All right, here's my thing. I don't know anything that happened. All right, I know I have heard Maj Touré's name. I know Daniel, what's his face? What's the...
Daniel Hayes.
Daniel Hayes. All right. So Daniel, I've only met at the last convention in New Orleans, but before then, he knew that I had some like media experience. And so he hit me up and asked me for the New Orleans convention. He asked me for advice on how to set up, or I think I asked him for media credentials, maybe. I forget what how we got connected, but it was around media. And he said there wasn't going to be a media area. And I said, dude, that's like the dumbest thing you could do. Like, you have to have a dedicated space for the media to like come and get their work done. And, you know, in Vegas, they had like a room set apart for people. So I was like, you have to set this up. And so we kind of, I worked with him for a few days to kind of help get that stuff set up. He gave me credentials and a booth and all that. And that's why I ended up going to New Orleans, because he was like, hey, here, have a table, you know. And so in 2018, I just did a bunch of traveling for the show. So he hits me up again this year, and we've talked a couple times since. And I posted something positive about Tom Woods, and like just out of the blue, he sent me in a message the picture of Tom Woods in front of Confederate flags, and I just didn't even reply because it's like,
he's the guy you interviewed about the whole Ron Paul thing.
Yes, yeah. So because he was at the center of the entire Ron Paul stuff too, allegedly, and so. You know, Sam Goldstein, who I think is still on the committee, I worked for, great guy, straight shooter, tells it like it is. He just basically said, like, Michael Heiss and the Mises Caucus took the Ron Paul stuff, they twisted it to make it look like we weren't doing anything so they could get hits. I totally believe that. But I also, after kind of talking to Daniel over the last couple years, get the vibe that, like, he is kind of...
pushing their buttons too.
Yes, he was definitely pushing his buttons. The anti-Tom Woods message makes me think that he has a vested interest, but there's also in him like a bit of erraticism, I guess is maybe the way to put it, which is why I think his story with the Maj Touré thing doesn't really, he's saying one thing privately and another thing publicly. I just think that's what he does. Like, he had like a service dog in New Orleans, and the dog like took a shit in one of the restaurants at the hotel. Like, I don't know. There's a whole situation going on there that I don't know. He's just been super nice to me and very helpful, and he had a couple questions and has asked my advice on the press stuff for Austin next year. And I said, you know, I gave him my opinion on the stuff, and he offered me like the prime booth for the press and like the main exhibitor hall. Like, it was a great position, like right on the corner. And I said, I'm not going, because I'm not going to next year's convention. I just not missing race day and family traditions for Libertarian Party stuff anymore. Like, I'm just done. Like, and so I turned down that booth, you know. And so I just said, hey, thanks, I'm not going, so I appreciate it. And so that's my experience with him, Daniel Hayes, which I get, like, I see the erraticism in this whole thing. But I also have to say this before you jump in, Reinhold. The people that we make a big deal out of are the ones with big Twitter accounts or podcasts full of libertarians that have already made up. Their audiences are made up of people who already have made up their mind about the Libertarian Party. Like, they're going to join or they're not going to join. Like, the people, like, the people that are upset about this have already made up their mind about the LP. They're not bringing a ton of new people to the party. The people that we don't celebrate are the guys like Joe Hauptman or Greg Noland or Bart Godow or Aaron Pyle or the dozens of Hoosier libertarians of Hoosier libertarians that I've worked with over the last 10 years that don't seek out credit. They don't seek out to be celebrated. They don't seek out any. They have given, you know, I was talking to a friend and she's like, well, he really gave a lot to run for this or that, and he gave a lot to join the party. He goes, so does every other libertarian I've ever met. Mm-hmm. Like, it costs them time and money and status and fighting and family. Like, it costs them a lot, like, to do this. But, you know, you're never going to hear Greg Noland or Bart Godow on Tom Woods' podcast. But these guys who have somewhat of a following come into the party and just expect those guys who have spent 30 years in the party to just kiss their ass because they've got 9,000 Twitter followers and somewhat of a social proof online where it really isn't going to translate too much to the party. Like, I just kind of go, this is egotistical and silly, and I don't know that that's what Maj is doing. It's just been a trend that I've noticed over the last, like, four or five years where celebritarians who are outside the party join the party and just expect us all to kiss their ass because they joined the party that has the word libertarian in it. Like, yeah.
They're doing us a favor is what they think.
Yeah. You're not doing anybody a favor. Yeah. You're just telling your crowd of libertarians that probably aren't going to really do anything with the party anyways. Hmm. Like, all I've really seen from the Mises crowd is just more agitation. Like, you're supporting Joshua Smith. Okay. So, I don't really feel sorry for Maj Touré because he said some sort of slur towards somebody for something, pissed off a major donor and got disinvited or quit. I just don't really give a fuck.
Right. Well, I think he quit and then got disinvited at the same time. So he made his
public thing. You can't fire me. I quit.
Yeah. He made some, this is stupid. Well, the problem was he was getting a lot of people pushing back and saying he shouldn't be the keynote speaker because of all this stuff, the nationalism, the anti-immigration stances. You know, he's for guns, and that was the big push for him to be a libertarian but he was rough around the edges on some of the other aspects of the philosophy, as it were. And his personality was one of, I know what I'm doing, I can't learn anything new, therefore you all need to shut up and do what I say because I'm the one who's doing all this for you.
Which is
very common. And I think a lot of people just got offended about that and started pushing back on him. And then the pushing back, you know, it's kind of like with Trump. When you push back on him, he lashes out and swings, right? And starts, you know, trying to – he just can't let it go. He pushes and pushes and pushes back harder and harder, and a lot of people just started having a problem with him. And he didn't like the fact that people were telling him that they didn't want him to do the keynote, that they weren't going to show up to the convention because he was the keynote speaker. And he said, I'm tired of this infighting. That's why I'm leaving the party. And then immediately was disinvited and everything else.
You get questioned, so now you're leaving the party. Okay.
How dare they?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why I quit the party. People were trying to question me.
And as much as I can say about Joshua, he did eat a lot of shit. And stayed.
Yeah.
I give him credit for that.
Yeah.
Right. I wish he'd have learned more from it, but he still stuck it out and done some good work while he's out there. He's like, done a lot of work? Some bad work, but
what good work has that guy done?
Here's the thing. He does individual bringing of people on, right? So he evangelizes the party. He goes out and gets people excited about it.
Those people are newer.
Well, they say the libertarians, but they don't like the current party because of the who the leader is, and it's too left wing, and socialists are taking. I know,
like
it's not,
such that's such dog.
Those are the people he's bringing in.
Yeah, he's right? So.
But at least he's going out and doing that. You know, I'll give him credit for that. I think he's targeting the wrong people, and he's not pushing back on some of those thoughts.
Students for Liberty won actual representative seats, including a write-in ballot. I think it was in Virginia they won a state house seat with a write-in versus a Democrat. Like, Students for Liberty is actually doing the work that the Libertarian Party should be doing, and the Libertarian Party is, as we said in the last bonus episode, mostly worthless. Like, so... there's just not any, and I have pissed off a lot of people lately, especially my Henry County Boss Hog friends, because I basically said, like, the truth, which is, I get that in Henry County, it is working there, but that's one county out of 5,000 where anything is working. The rest of, like, it's just not worth the time.
There were a couple hundred libertarians elected last week, right? So... there's still stuff moving forward, but how much of that is the state party and how much of it is national? And really, the state parties are the bread and butter of the Libertarian Party anyway, right? So that's what the thing that everybody wants to try and make this a top-down organization, and it's never really been that. It's never wanted. We never wanted it to be that. It was always going to be local up.
Right.
Yeah, we'd like to have, you know, senators and congressmen and president elected that are libertarian, but we also push to get the local people in place. Right. So,
right.
And people are coming in and saying, that's what the party is doing wrong. They should be focused on local elections. I'm like, they are focused on local elections. What are you talking about? That's where we make our bread and butter.
Harry, anything that you'd like to add before we start the show?
I've never once nor ever been a member of the Libertarian National Party or the state party. That's it.
Okay.
That's all I got.
Yep. All right. Where's my phone at? I need to turn that volume off.
Because you're all a bunch of socialist status with that.
Oh. Oh, here we go. It's over here. All right.
Authoritarianism.
Yeah. Your parties are violence.
This meeting is being recorded.
Oh, crap. All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle, and I am so glad to be here with you. If you are, well, tonight's red meat. We're going to pick on Elizabeth Warren and Medicare for All. And when we give you the details, you're just going to go, WTF. This is a bigger fantasy than, I mean, a voluntarist society is more likely than this working. So it's just amazing. Socialists are always coming up with new crazy ideas. And we'll discuss that right after this.
Warning. This show is for adults, produced by semi-adults. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves.
There has been lie after lie.
We toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, a 15-year veteran of politics and media, Chris Spangle.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the program. We are discussing Medicare for All and Elizabeth Warren's plan coming up. It's really unbelievable. You know, every time you think that the Democrats can't come up with something crazier, they certainly have. But we'll treat it with dignity and respect on the other side of these introductions. I want to say the man shaking his head no that he will not is our good friend Harry Price. Harry, how are you? Both of you are going to have to unmute if you want to talk in the program.
Well, you know, I just want to make sure I didn't say something like inappropriate during the intro and other things, you know.
I let you stay home. I allow it, and then this is how you repay me with your unprofessionalism.
See, he can't have the button there. He also can't have it at home.
That's exactly right. That is Reinhold. Reinhold's back. Reinhold will be on. I have not told him this, but he's going to be on a little more often because he's very well informed. And we're also going to soon have the Empress of Meme on, so stay tuned for that. She's very, very, very intelligent, and she runs the best Instagram page, Empress of Meme, like impressive meme, but E-M-P-R-E-S-S-O-F meme. So, Harry, it is like 12 degrees outside. We had a freak, weird November snowstorm with like 4 inches of snow and ice last night here in Indianapolis. Normally, we don't get this kind of weather until well into January. It's been very temperate. I remember having snowy Thanksgivings as a kid, but not as an adult, really. So Harry was just beside himself. He couldn't go out in the weather, and his new contract says that if it is below 20 degrees, he gets to stay home. So everybody's at Zoom, snug, nestled in their beds. And here we are. We're all online. So, Harry, I hope you have some comfy shoes on.
First off, fake news. The contract does say that I don't have to come out under 20, but we'll come if all Chris has to do is turn the fireplace on.
Okay.
He refuses to turn the fireplace on. Okay.
Well, as you know, I use premium hardwood, which is $5 for basically 3 logs at the local gas station. So that's a steep demand. So it's just cheaper to do it this way.
Yeah, it was really, really freaking cold. Glad I upgraded to the newer Subaru. It took it like a champ.
My car didn't even get warm till I got to work 20 minutes later. It was, and I didn't have any washer fluid either. I'm basically like a college girl. I have no gas. I have no washer fluid. I haven't changed the oil in 3,000 in like 10,000 miles. Like, I need someone to come take care of my car.
At least you got the new tires.
Yes, I have the new tires. They're about a year old, though. So,
oh, did the brakes get fixed?
I have new brakes. I have new tires. Oh,
yes. Oh, I almost forgot I never did those brakes.
Oh, yeah. Sex is great, but have you ever had four new tires with new brakes? It's the best because you can drive like a maniac.
Mm-hmm. But have you done new tires, new brakes with new suspension?
No. I've never had a car that long. It usually blows up before I need suspension.
I wonder why if you don't change the oil every 10,000.
Shut up.
I'm curious, right?
We're not going to belabor the point too much. We're going to kind of get right into it tonight because we have a very information-packed show. Okay, so I'm going to do a Dan Carlin preface here. So, you know, Dan's always good at kind of... So on this one, here's how I want you to think about the show. So there is a proposal by Elizabeth Warren... Basically, she put numbers to Medicare for All, which is basically socialized medicine in the United States. It's jam-packed full of information. We have notes, 16 pages long, thanks to Sam Schultz. They're unbelievably great notes, so you can kind of go check those out. There's all kinds of extra information that we just won't speak here on the program. You can check out kind of when we do these kind of explainer shows where we give you the details of a news story, we really want to make sure that you get the information, you know, from the sources what we're talking about, and then we react to those sources. We try to be journalistic in our approach in that we don't assume the story based on the ephemera of Facebook statuses and Twitter headlines. We try to actually dig deep and give you some research and make you sound smarter when you're talking about this stuff and give libertarian opinion on the news along the way. Now, sometimes in these explainer shows, it's very easy, like in the Kurds episode, where there's not a ton of notes. But when you have a plan that is going to basically reshape the entire economy and all of healthcare, and Elizabeth Warren puts it out and gives you specific details, there's a lot of information there. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this as long as we're going to try and not bore you with it. Because there's a ton of details that I want to give you because I think they're important details that really highlight the overarching philosophy that both Elizabeth Warren is trying to push and the philosophy that we are trying to push back with. So this may not be a terribly long episode tonight. We may do a part two. You know, if we go an hour and we're just exhausted with too many details, we'll just quit. And then come back and do a part two. But I just wanted to make sure that you know, hey, there may be in this episode, all of the information may not be in this particular episode. We're actually talking about doing an entire healthcare series around this, not just on this, but also what's the history of healthcare? That socialized medicine has been in the American political scene since Woodrow Wilson and his administration. A little bit before even, you know, the HMO Act. Obviously, you had Medicare and Medicaid being created under LBJ. You had the HMO Act under Nixon that was greatly impactful that very few people talk about. And then also Obamacare. So we're going to do some history. We're going to talk about the more in-depth on some of the proposals. And then we're going to give you some libertarian alternatives to some of this stuff. But by criticizing her plan, we're hopefully going to get you to think differently about healthcare, which is incredibly important. Now, all of this work is funded by our patrons. And so if you are a fan of We Are Libertarians or if you've learned something from this show, then you can thank all of our patrons. You can find out more at WeAreLibertarians.com. But we especially want to thank our $100 a month contributors, starting with Craig DaCosta, who I saw was in Boston recently, one of my favorite towns. I think it was Boston. Somewhere on the East Coast. I was jealous that where he was and where I was, but I was not. Christy Avery, probably watching in the hot tub right now. Jason Doolittle, Jeff Bennett, Matthew Durbin, and Ed Brehab. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for supporting our work. And we are always looking for more people to help support our work, especially as we head into election season. I don't know about you two. I'm not sure if you two are experts on socialized medicine. I have feel like I have damn near become an expert after these past a few days of research, but Medicare for All is basically the single-payer healthcare system that has really Bernie Sanders began pushing and has kind of articulated support for it the most. And then Elizabeth Warren signed on and said that she was a fan of it. And Bernie Sanders has given some details, and Elizabeth Warren gave no details. And so she's the candidate who is constantly saying, I have a plan for that. And this is the one thing she didn't have a plan for. And so she's like, so the Sanders campaign and his supporters, especially the supporters in the media, kept pushing her to give details on her Medicare for All plan. And so she did something incredibly stunning, brave, and stupid all at the same time, and gave not just some details, but several pages of a plan, a full funding mechanism for all of this. She ascribed actual numbers to it. The total cost of her transition is $52 trillion. Now, she says, well, you know, in the next 10 years, Americans will spend $52 trillion on healthcare, and so we're just swapping that out for Medicare for All as opposed to just whatever system we have now. Now, it seems so simple. Like, it just, you go, Harry, we're just going to switch it, right? We're just going to flip it, okay? So instead of it being a private sector, private, quasi-private public sector healthcare system that we have now, we're just going to flip it, and it's going to be all public. It'll be $52 trillion. Even though the Urban Institute says it would cost $59 trillion, she just managed to find in $7 trillion in savings just by cutting waste, which that's anytime you hear cutting waste.
$7 trillion. Magical. But yeah, you find $7 trillion in the magical.
Elizabeth Warren is going to just flip it. It's that easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It's not.
Flip it, do some magic, put some spin on it, you know, because you're going to spend this money anyways.
Yeah, that's right.
So we're going to spend it for you.
Yes.
In ways that we deem fit.
That is the key part of it. The way that Elizabeth Warren sees fit, the overconfidence in this plan and the stunning lack of understanding of basic economics and just bullshit, frankly, mm-hmm. That we're about to lay out is frightening. It is stupid. It is intelligently dumb. I don't know. I just think you're going to be impressed with someone who has no awareness of how the real world works. No awareness of incentives for the average person, but mm-hmm. just thinks that she alone, by sheer will of force, can reshape 20% of the economy with no ill effects whatsoever. Everybody will just go, yeah, good idea. Now that I've read this, let's completely change the economy.
And human will.
Yeah.
Just will. Just the right. way humans work, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that'll get changed too.
Yeah. So... So Elizabeth Warren has a plan for healthcare, and that's kind of what we're going to go through. But I want to spend some time on Elizabeth Warren because I think Elizabeth Warren is a sincere, intelligent person who is doing the right thing by trying to tell people what she's going to do in detail. And I think as a citizen who votes, a citizen who just cares, a citizen who wants to understand what our elected leadership might do, considering they have the force of government, meaning they have a gun and you don't. I want to understand exactly what they will do, not just sort of the vague promises. And so I find it admirable and to be applauded that Elizabeth Warren would take a step that put out specific plans for something that cost $52 trillion. I'm not being sarcastic at all. I wish more candidates would do that, but they don't because she's getting absolutely slaughtered over this because it's so crazy pants. And so Bernie Sanders rightly just says, well, we're going to do it. We're going to change the economy. We're going to make the rich pay for it. And everybody goes, yay. But then when you actually get into the details of what Congress might work through, it's just not that simple. So I do applaud her for having the guts to put her neck on the line when she's a potential front runner and put out something so specific, because I really do think in the day and age of the websites with four bullet points, and that's the extent of their plans for America, it is courageous that she took a step. Do you or do you not agree with me on this?
Oh.
Anyone. Am I here alone?
Harry was taking that one, but right?
I thought Ryan was taking that one.
No. I find her, I think she was pressured into it. I don't think she wanted to do this, but she still did it. So good for her. I mean, the whole point of having the election is to find out what everybody stands for so that we can make the right choice in president. So coming out on the record and saying, this is what I want to do, knowing she's going to get killed for it. I mean, that's brave, right?
Yeah.
Because so many politicians are just like, we'll work those details out. And as long as we have the right vision, we'll get there and everything else. And they never really get into the details.
I just don't think she thought she was going to get killed for this. I literally think this is her plan. This is how she did everything. This is how she got in the office. Just like, I put my plan down on the paper. I execute it.
I do think there's some truth to that. Yeah. I'll just get the typical conservatives who just don't like me. But she has, Joe Biden has criticized her. Bernie Sanders has criticized her, saying that it's bad for jobs. When Bernie Sanders says something, this is bad for jobs. She's been criticized by the New York Times. She's been criticized by many people on the left.
Fox.
I would count them in sort of the usual players. But like the National Review is going to write a column against it, right? Like, there's no surprise when they do it. It's more surprising when your rivals actually. The problem, I think, for most Democrats running for president right now, specifically Elizabeth Warren, is you don't get when you get pushback in very serious ways, as conservatives and libertarians often do in the public sphere from the mainstream media, it makes you sharpen your arguments more. And Elizabeth Warren is so beloved by most of the people in the chattering class and the Voxes of the world and the New York Times and the Washington Post that she doesn't get a lot of pushback. So I don't know that they've necessarily as a campaign known what to do with criticism from usually fairly consistent allies. So
yeah, I mean,
go ahead, Harry, go ahead.
All right. So but my thing with Warren is just like, she sees that, but she is such a, the typical New Englander, this is, I know better than everyone else in the other piece of crap states that's not New England. This is our plan. This is what we're going to do. You all suck. Mm-hmm. And they don't care. It's like, and the price doesn't matter to them because it's like, no, yeah, we're going to pay that.
Right.
We're going to pay that. This is what we're going to do. Because that's what they freaking do in Massachusetts. No, this is what we're going to do. The big dig is going to cost billions of dollars. So we're going to dig a hole in the ocean. Right. That's what we're doing.
Dennis.
Well, it's also and I got sidetracked.
Sorry.
But I think to her, it seems like a big vision thing to, like Kennedy saying, we're going to put a man on the moon. We're going to fix this and this. We're not going to worry about the cost. We're going to worry about what's right and do this big thing because we can, because we're Americans. So we're able to do that. But the details and what the problem is, they don't understand the problems that are the healthcare system. And because they don't understand that, they don't have the right fix for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Right. So I think that's where the real problem comes in on this, where she thinks she's doing the right thing because her ideology tells her this is the right thing. But until you understand the reasons why it won't work or the reasons why current have doesn't work, you're never going to get a successful result.
Yeah. Go ahead, Harry.
And other reasons why the Medicare system hasn't been expanded upon. Why haven't anyone opened this program up? Why? Or why has it sit this very small? Or why don't people like being on to it? Why is there Medicaid assistance? Or why is there holes in Medicaid? And why do people like to get insurance because of the holes in it? You've ever asked yourself that question? Why don't people, if Medicaid is such a shining jewel of everything, then people be ecstatic about it. So they're like, man, I've got this.
And people don't want to be on Medicare and Medicaid. They want to be on private insurance by and large. And make no mistake that this would absolutely end the private insurance market. The private insurance market, people scapegoat health insurance companies and drug companies and medical providers and doctors and all that. What people hate are the high costs. Mm-hmm. But what people don't understand is the high costs are caused by government intervention and regulation. And so, you know, just look at basic principles of insurance. Insurance is essentially you pay into a pool of money, mm-hmm. and everybody pays into it. Maybe not at the exact same rate, but an insurance provider will essentially look at you and your history and your medical background and say, you know, your risk is higher for diabetes, so therefore you must pay more. You know, my family has heart disease and I'm overweight, whereas Harry is in shape and the same age. So Harry, because he takes better care of himself, or medically on paper looks like he takes better care of himself, insurance companies, hey, I'm going to Orange Theory and working my butt off, okay? So I'm not saying I'm unhealthy. But on paper, you look like a much safer risk than me. Now, overarching, black men have a higher risk of heart disease and diabetes, okay? So that factors in. But you and I are the same age. You're of a healthy weight. I'm of a non-healthy weight. So you'd pay into the pool a little less than I would. Now, Dennis mm-hmm. is significantly older than both of us. Many, many, many decades older than Harry and I. I'm just kidding, Reinhold.
You're actually true.
But because he is older, he would pay more than I would pay. So a health insurance market essentially functions that way. So it's based on where you live. It's based on many different factors. If you want to know more, watch About Schmidt, the great movie with Jack Nicholson, and it explains insurance to you very well. And as the government moves in, now basically you take from the pool when you need resources from the pool, right? And mm-hmm. so the markets kind of function based on need and risk, and it just kind of, I don't know how to describe a market without seeming cliche, I guess, because what the left has done such a good job of is making a lot of our arguments sound cliche. But what happens is there's risk, right? So there's risk to the company in insuring you. What happens with a government-backed market, as we've seen with student loans, is that there's really no risk. There is you take out of the pool what you need to, and then we'll find the money from somewhere, usually just by inflating the currency through printing money at the Federal Reserve. So the problem is that if you have a public option, or worse, you have a Medicare for all single payer system, then there is no price competition. Because there is no risk, you will just have many, many more users using things, and there is no you have to be covered. It's not even a choice. You're covered. And so there's no risk to the government. They just pay. They find a way to pay for it. And so cost just massively spirals out of control. And the problem is that when you set up systems, as they're trying to set up and they have set up, where a lot of the government government public option plans are paid for by private insurance markets or private taxpayers, you have or through taxes on corporations or wealthy individuals, those people start canceling their private plans and put more people onto the public option, and so therefore the private markets just sort of atrophy very quickly. They run out of resources to function because you've redistributed the wealth from the private plans to the public plans. Did I make sense with all of that? Was I clear enough, do you think?
Yeah, I think you were clear.
Okay.
And there's some stuff to add to that too, because one of the problems with doing this type of solution, right, to the problem, the healthcare problem, is that you're paying into the pool. You're usually paying in the pool based off your risk. So if you choose, you know, some of that risk is stuff that you can't do anything about, but some of that risk is stuff that you can do stuff about, whether you're overweight, whether you eat the right types of foods, you keep a healthy lifestyle, you work out, that sort of thing, choosing to smoke or not to smoke, those types of things. So that determines how much you pay in. When you get into a program like this, a government program, everybody pays in based off of some other determination factor, right? Mm-hmm. So you start getting you start getting politics involved in the into the system. And when you get politics involved in the system, you're going to end up with, well, the poorer people shouldn't pay as much as the rich people because rich people can afford it. And therefore it doesn't matter what lifestyle you choose, you're going to be taken care of and somebody else is end up paying for it.
Right.
And that's where the moral hazard gets pulled away.
It removes all incentive for you to be a responsible consumer because you have no fiduciary interest in making sure that you take care of yourself because somebody else will pay for it.
Correct. And that's why like people will take these ridiculous majors in college because meh, whatever, right. Someone will pay for it. You know, you exported the risk and you moved it down the line to make other people pay for it. It's what the United States government's very good at. The mm-hmm. other thing is blowing things up. But
yes. Yeah, just look at our debt. That's, you know, how our kids and grandkids are going to be paying for that. For our good time that we're paying for right now, that we're experiencing right now, that's going to be paid for by somebody else.
Yes, correct. You heard of the great time that we're all having.
So horrible.
All right. So this is technically close to what we're doing too, but this one thing I have, this question is, I need Ryan holding it, right? Because in my lifetime, I've watched the national debt just grow crazy, right? And I remember I did a podcast of talking about how crazy the number a trillion is, like how crazy, ridiculous, you don't really understand what a trillion really looks like. Mm-hmm. And now we're just throwing the word trillion around like it's nothing.
Yeah. We're almost talking 100 trillion. You know, we're talking $59 trillion. Do you guys realize how much that money that is? You know, it's just crazy. You know, last year the GDP increased $1 trillion and our debt increased $1.3 trillion. Now, anybody can do the math on that and find out how we're doing well as in the economy right now, supposedly, mm-hmm. is because we're just borrowing the money and putting it into the system.
You just can't let Trump win, can you? You just got to shit on his economy.
This isn't Trump, though. This has been going on for years and years. Obama did the same thing. We're just continuing Obama's policies right now. I mean, that's the reality of it.
But, right. Yeah.
Which is the continuation of Bush's policies.
But when you get into the healthcare specifically too, and when we talk about how healthcare costs are skyrocketing and so high, what people don't understand is that most of that is smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. Right. So the insurance company wants you to think that they're doing you a service. They're doing you a great job. Now, the reality is that most people who pay into private insurance is getting screwed. Mm-hmm. There is no way they're going to make a profit. And the profits that insurance companies make usually aren't that high. They're like 2-3%. They're not, you know, 50% profit and all sorts of stuff. So they're not making bank. They're making it in volume.
Right.
But mm-hmm. what they do is they say, you know, all these people paying in, you're paying in how much you think, you know, for your just to be covered. Most people don't use that much.
Right.
If they had put it in a savings account, they could have paid out of pocket for what the actual cost of that service was and come out on a better end. But it doesn't look that way because on paper, what the insurance company does then is say, we're only going to pay X amount for this procedure. And the doctors realize, hey, I'm only going to get X amount for this procedure because they're going to knock off 65% or 70%. So we'll raise our rates up to make it, you know, to make it so when they cut that, we're still getting paid enough for us to make a profit. Right. And then the insurance company, and then they go back and forth and they come to an agreement on what a good inflated number is mm-hmm. so that they both look like they're doing something valuable. And the consumer ends up seeing this bill that says, oh, $10,000 for an aspirin and all sorts of stuff. But look, if you look real close, the insurance only pays a fraction of that.
Yeah,
and they say negotiated price and the price is less. So they're really not paying that much. Everybody's getting scammed into thinking they're making the good financial decision, having that insurance for everyday needs, mm-hmm. when the reality is most people should just pay doctors what they need to pay for basic stuff, going to the doctor, you know, annual checkups, that sort of thing. And when you get into catastrophic care is when you get into the actually lower cost insurance for catastrophic care that people would pay into just to cover for, you know, heart attacks and unknown things, diseases you didn't know, like cancer and things like that coming around. So that's really the best way to solve that problem. But nobody sees that problem because they're all mesmerized by these huge numbers and we have to do something. And then they get politics involved into it and just kind of keep a blind eye to it.
Yeah, the insurance companies are really, in a lot of ways, the villains. Like, I don't know how much I can say. I probably shouldn't say much, but the reality is that with drug prices, for instance, it's the insurance companies doing the math, and they're basically taking highly discounted drugs from drug companies. So they beat down the drug companies to give them highly discounted drugs, and then they beat down the distributors, aka pharmacies and doctors, to give they make up their money by basically overcharging the public for a lot of these drug prices, and drug companies take a lot of the hit. It's insurance companies that really kind of keep things inflated. Wish I could. I have to talk to my sources to make sure that I can tell you kind of more on that. But just know the Chris Spangle guarantee. It's the insurance companies that you should hate.
And the funny thing is that we could talk about the insurance companies being the evil, but the reason why the insurance companies are as powerful as they are now is because of government when this whole thing ramped up back in the 30s when they did price freezing for salaries. So the FDR, they said, okay, we're going to freeze everybody's prices, everybody's salaries, so nobody can get paid more. Well, companies wanted to have they wanted to go still get the better people and entice them some way. So they said, hey, we'll just start paying for we'll just buy you health insurance and you don't have to pay anything and we'll take care of it for you. And that's how businesses got into the insurance game. They weren't doing that before. And it just became the industry at the time to where they got their foot in the door and it wasn't going anywhere after that. Everybody expects that from a company's.
Okay, right.
It's a benefit that you expect.
Yeah.
But to go touch on it, then we can go on. But to touch on the point that the other way the insurance company make money off of people is very predatorial, awful. They make money off of also young, healthy men. Mm-hmm. A lot of men purchase health insurance and they never go take a yearly checkout. Yeah. They just do not and will not until something's drastically wrong with them in their 40s. But they've been paying for health insurance up until their 40s.
Yeah.
Every month, send that check in and never do anything with it. It's just like, nope, that's what my job has. And then when they get a spouse, they pay for their health insurance, they pay for their spouse's health insurance, and they still do not go to the doctor.
All right. So let's jump into some of the details of what Elizabeth Warren has put into her report. Our source is basically the report. And details from that. Again, show notes are found at WeAreLibertarians.com in the show notes section of your podcast app or on the website. Thank you to Sam for the great notes. So she starts out the whole plan, and if I might give some unsolicited advice to Elizabeth Warren that she will never hear, maybe you should stop with the personal stories. She starts the plan. You know, my papaw had a heart attack and it nearly bankrupted the family and we almost lost the farm. And it's like, you are the least credible candidate in the race, competing with Donald Trump for the most dishonest about family stories and personal histories. And, you know, I'm going to avoid using Pocahontas despite thinking it's the funniest thing that Donald Trump has ever said. Maybe you shouldn't, but this has been, she just can't, she thinks her personal story really helps. And it's just like, dude, nobody believes you anymore. You weren't pregnant when you got fired or whatever that whole thing was. She's full of crap. She's such a politician, but she appears like just your regular soccer mom out there who is a professor. And I don't know, she has something where she seems credible. She feels like she's credible and she's just lies through her teeth about so much stuff. But I really think that Elizabeth Warren is a dangerous combination of like Wilsonian idealism, overconfidence, and just ignorance of basic economics, as you'll kind of see. So she starts out a story talking of, you know, personal story, and this is why I want to do this. And, you know, we had troubles, and many, many people have a lot of problems with their health care, and they kind of give you the same thing where people are eating dog food or paying for their health care, which I don't know about you guys, but the several 10, 12, 13,000 people listening, I bet there are situations where prescription drug prices, for instance, our friend Phyllis, who I know is watching, hello to Phyllis, pays an outrageous amount of money for her cancer treatment drugs. And we did a cost episode that I'll put in the show notes about it. But you know, so there are legitimate problems, but they always trot out, you know, grandma's eating dog food and, instead of because she's paying for medicine, that sort of thing. So lowering the cost of prescription drugs is kind of the first pillar of her plan. And so under her Affordable Drug Manufacturing Act, she's going to allow the Department of Human Health and Services to step in where the market has failed. All right, so you guys are going to have to hop in because we're going to do a lot of reading till the end of this episode through these details. But this is a recurring theme through this plan. The market has failed, so I need to intervene into this situation with the government. She basically would give the ability of HHS to manufacture generic drugs in cases in which no company is manufacturing a drug, when only one or two companies manufacture a drug and its price has spiked, when the drug is in shortage, or when a medicine listed as essential by the World Health Organization faces limited competition and high prices. Now, would either of you take a drug manufactured by the government?
Of course, I trust them.
Other than Soma.
I trust them completely. They make sure my water is clean to drink. Yeah, I can trust them that.
The roads are well paved.
Yeah, what roads,
lines of your DMV are short.
Oh yeah, DMV lines. I can do it all digital.
Peace is flourished throughout the earth. Another part of it is, were you going to say something more? Or we're going to continue joking.
Oh no, you can go.
Okay. Another part of it is the mental health part. She would add the CARE Act, the C-A-R-E Act. It would invest $100 billion in federal funding over the next 10 years in states and communities to fight the mental health crisis. It gives direct
red flag law, gun confiscation in the back door.
It gives directly to first responders, public health departments, and communities on the front lines of this crisis so that they have the resources to provide prevention, treatment, and recovery services for those who need it most.
I've heard this before. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, that was the education system.
Right. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would invest $100 billion over 10 years, and then it would just they wouldn't keep that money flowing into local communities, and they wouldn't be cripplingly dependent on federal funding, would they?
Right. And also you get to the point where they say, well, we're giving you this money. We have some conditions now.
Yeah.
And you need to do this, and you need to do it this way and the way we say.
Here's where you're a small thinker, unlike Elizabeth Warren. Education is so much better than the 1970s when the DOE was created. So
yeah, because test scores, you can see the graph, and I don't know. To me, it seems like it's going in the opposite direction we want it to. But
well, again, that's your small.
Who
thinking,
am I?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just
a person
just
who's a person who's racist. Read facts. Right. Yeah. You're a racist.
Racist
Reinhold. It also works to strengthen our addiction treatment infrastructure, expanding access to medication-assisted treatment and ensuring treatment programs and recovery residences that they meet high standards. The government loves to impose standards and fines and never they love to tell you what you have to do through mandates and then never fund those. And Elizabeth's plan would help hold drug manufacturers accountable for pushing powerful and addictive drugs that contribute to the epidemic, the opioid epidemic. Now
they help create
which the government helps create, right? So protecting access to health care in rural communities. Medicare for all will mean access to primary care and lower health costs for patients and less uncompensated care for rural hospitals, helping them stay afloat. Elizabeth will create a new Medicare designation for rural hospitals that reimburses them at a higher rate and offers flexibility of services to meet the needs of their communities. Elizabeth will also strengthen antitrust protections to fight hospital mergers that increase costs, lower quality, and close rural facilities. Now, we're kind of seeing there was an article in the Indy Star recently that Cass County, which is the I think the least populated county in the state of Indiana out of 92, had 15 players on their football team, and they're going to shut down the only football team in the county because they just don't have enough kids going to the school to justify the cost of a football team. So what you're seeing in rural communities is that people in the millennial and Generation Z, and presumably whatever comes after that, are moving out of these rural communities, and they're not replacing that population. And so healthcare, if you have a market-based system, They're not able to keep up and keep the best doctors. And, you know, and that's pretty typical in a state like Indiana. People who are from an hour or two north or south typically come to Indianapolis to go to Methodist or IU or, well, not Wishard, or St. Francis or St. Vincent's. But so, you know, I if you can travel to a specialist in a bigger city, I don't know why it's important to force revenue into places. You know, you obviously need good emergency technicians, but why force specialists and funding into rural areas when they're not really needed because of population?
Because most of the people who live out in those communities are going to be left after eventually is just going to be the ultra wealthy who have their just country houses.
That's
like
true.
I said, this right. is New England thinking. This yes. is like, oh yeah, I've got a house in Boston, but yeah, I'm going to go up to the
Jackson. Vineyard. Jackson Hole is owned. Jackson Hole, Wyoming is owned by basically Kanye West and David Letterman now. So
yeah, but think about that. You put this hospital there with few people and then you've got to staff that, so you have to hire people so people move into it could revitalize that whole county.
Right. Instead of spreading
with federal funds
instead of spreading resources then, right. Yeah.
Jobs program.
Obviously where public money flows, job creation flows after it.
Oh yes, yeah. It's very simple. Simple economics.
If you don't understand sarcasm, this is a very difficult episode. We're completely full of shit. So Elizabeth's plan will increase funding for community health centers by 15% per year over 5 years and establish a $25 billion capital fund to support a menu of options for improving access to care and health professional shortage areas. She will grow the current health workforce in rural communities by lifting the cap on medical residency placements, targeting in underserved areas by 15,000 over the next 5 years and increasing the National Health Service Corps and the Indian Health Service loan repayment programs. I had to hold back the Pocahontas jokes to full loan repayment. And her plan will invest in the future health workforce by dramatically scaling up apprenticeship programs between unions, high schools, community colleges, and a wide array of healthcare professionals to build a healthcare workforce that is rooted in the community. Translation, we're going to staff up workforce by recruiting a lot of inexperienced people because we know there's going to be a massive shortage, even more than there already is thanks to Obamacare.
Well, and by the way, for the Pocahontas thing, just to kind of give some background, that should be credited to the people who came up with it first, which was No Agenda. They were saying it 3 years before Trump was.
Yeah. I mean, she's Elizabeth Warren is the type of politician who gets made fun of. We've done an episode on it. I'll see if I can find it in the show notes. I'll put in the link in there because Harry and I have covered it. But basically, she said she was Native American on a form to help get her hired at Harvard. And she, you know, she has a very common, like, in my family, we've always been told we're 1/16th Choctaw and Cherokee. Yeah. Like, my great-great-grandmother was full-blooded Indian. And, like, the genetic test that my sister took does not bear that out whatsoever. Like, she has a very common American story where someone in your family 3 generations ago told some bullshit. You know, and so I get that, but like at the same time, like don't double down and add your family chili recipe to powwow chow and run on office for on it. And, you know, and then release that you're 1/20/24th, like 1/2024th Native American. Like the memes were so savage.
Yeah. The 1/124 meme, 1/024 memes. I've made a few myself. Oh.
It was the funniest day of memes in a long time. I mean, it was brilliant, but
I mean, I kind of feel for her a little bit, but she brings it on herself.
She right? had,
I mean, don't make that your identity. Make your identity. I never understood this with people. It's like, you're you.
She leads with her chin. Like she doesn't need to, like she didn't need to put out that, you know, she's 1/20, you know, I don't know, man.
48th something.
You're right. Yeah.
It's unnecessary.
So she kind of starts with some of her broader principles in the plan. All my plans start with our shared values. There are 2 absolute non-negotiables when it comes to healthcare. 1, no American should ever die or go bankrupt because of healthcare costs. No more GoFundMe campaigns to pay for care. No more rationing insulin. No more choosing between medicine and groceries. I think every single person hearing this totally agrees that that should be the guiding principle of what we ought to aspire to see in our healthcare system. You know, nobody should have to go bankrupt because they're trying to get themselves well.
I understand that, but like, but GoFundMe is just a community charity arm. What's wrong with charity?
Charity's horrible. Charity's bad. Sorry. And the reason why charity is bad to people like Elizabeth Warren is because charity gives people the choice on whether or not to help somebody or not. And you're not smart enough to make that choice.
Right.
And you're going to be selfish and keep that money for yourself. So we need to make sure that you contribute just like everybody else.
Despite, like, we mentioned Methodist Hospital, which is the hospital that saved my grandfather's life. I think I've maybe said this on the show.
Oh,
he lost
just recently.
Yeah. I mean, Reinhold's had an experience where Methodist. It's an amazing hospital. You know why it's called Methodist? Because the Methodists in this town in the 19th century saw a need and pooled their money. The wealthy in Indianapolis pooled their money and built Methodist Hospital. The reality is that the 19th century model of insurance was effectively charity. It was people who saw a need. You see that same impulse in somebody like Bill Gates, who is worth $58, $60 billion. He's given away $39 billion, and this plan would tax him $9 billion. And liberal journalists were – the Libjos, as our friends on No Agenda say, were picking on Bill Gates saying – you know, he's so selfish that he doesn't want to give $9 billion to help pay for healthcare in America. Well, no, he doesn't want to give $9 billion to the government, which is completely corrupt and ineffective. He wants to give $9 billion to the direct partners that he works with that have had a verifiable, incredible impact on food and health in Africa, for instance. So the impulse for people who make a tremendous amount of money to go, I have too much, what can I do to help change the lives of others, is still there, but they don't trust it because a politician like Elizabeth Warren, as you will see, can't control it, and that's what pisses her off.
I mean, look at the – every year we hear about an audit for the Pentagon, and they find out that there's a few trillion dollars that we just can't really account for. Not that they necessarily wasted it or went to CIA special black ops or anything. Just kind of don't know what happened. It's somewhere.
So when you hear $7 trillion will be saved in Elizabeth Warren's plan by cost savings and effective streamlining, like, okay, all right. So
it's possible.
The second shared value, every American should be able to see the doctors they need and get their recommended treatments without having to figure out who is in-network. Oh, what a hardship. No for-profit insurance company should be able to stop anyone from seeing the expert or getting the treatment they need. Now, her plan fundamentally fails this second tenet. It fails on both of these accounts. At the end of this, we'll kind of revisit this again, but the fact is that your doctor will probably quit practicing medicine, and you will not have the opportunity to have them replaced because the ability to make money, aka repay their massive student loans, will no longer be there, as we'll see over the course of this plan. So she will fail her own test by the end of these episodes. So under my plan, Medicare for All will cover the full list of benefits outlined in the Medicare for All Act, including long-term care, audio, vision, dental, and mental health benefits. My plan covers every single person in the United States and includes common sense payment reforms that makes Medicare for All possible without spending any more overall than we spend now. So she outlined some options that we have. Maintain our current system, which will cost the country $52 trillion over 10 years. And under the current system, 24 million people won't have coverage and millions can't get long-term care. 63 million have coverage gaps or substandard coverage that could break down if they actually get sick. Together, the American people will pay $11 trillion of that bill themselves in the form of premiums, deductibles, copays, out-of-network, and other expensive medical equipment and care they pay for out-of-pocket, all while America's wealthiest individuals and biggest companies pay far less in taxes than in other major countries.
There it is.
Okay, this is some this is some Robespierre bullshit here. So the problem with this is that $52 trillion over 10 years is not public spending. that $52 trillion is the totality of all healthcare expenditures. So a person who, like my mother, who is a registered nurse, she does not work for the government. I'm sure part of her salary may come from Medicare or Medicaid reimbursements through her local community hospital that she works for. But she works for a private employer. She is not taking wealth out of the economy because she's living off of tax dollars. She's living off of income generated through private enterprise, private market forces, and so she is not a drag on the economy. That $11 trillion is people like my mother. It is the doctor that you see. It is the dentist that you go to. It is the hospital that you see. All of these jobs she has just assumed are a tax on all of Americans. She basically is making an option one here, the leap, that if you have to pay anything regarding your medical care, it is a tax on your life, which is fundamentally stupid because that's not how it works. A tax is something that you don't voluntarily pay. And so they typically try to force the argument that healthcare is a right, which we'll deal with in a moment, but it isn't because you have so much choice. You can go to the doctor or not go to the doctor. Nobody's compelling you to. But you can't avoid paying your taxes. So paying for the dentist is not a tax. So to treat out-of-network payments and premiums and deductibles as if it is some sort of tax, it is actually a tax now because you're compelled to have health insurance thanks to Barack Obama. But it wasn't before. So it's it's sort of just disingenuous to just treat it's a very sneaky turn of phrase that she's trying to present there, but we here at We Are Libertarians are too smart to fall for her BS.
Well, and the other thing too in that $52 trillion that she wants to keep spouting is that a third of that is most likely the cost associated with having to enforce all of the insurance junk, right? So two out of 5 days of your doctor's day is spent doing paperwork and filling out forms and fighting with insurance companies and everything else. And they're not looking at, if we were to get rid of that part of it, we would cut costs significantly. No, they want to add more enforcement, more cost onto it to make sure it happens. Because that's the one thing in here that I'm sure they don't talk about is enforcement of this.
Oh, no. She's pretty clear about how she's going to enforce it. And it's some gangster shit. What's the Murray Rothbard quote? You know, I'll have to find the gangster quote by Murray Rothbard, but it suits it perfectly. It's really stunning. So option two, switch to my approach to Medicare for all, which would cost the country just under $52 trillion in over 10 years. Now, we all know that government projections are always accurate, and there is no mission creep within government agencies. So like Social Security didn't start out just to help widowers and orphans. It now covers all Americans, for instance. And is massively Medicare and Medicaid were scored at some like few million dollars, and it would cost billions or something. Now, under this new system, every person in America, all 331 million people, will have full health coverage and coverage for long-term care, whether you like it or not. Everybody gets the doctors and the treatments they need, whether you like it or not, when they need them, and you're going to need them. Because you're going to be poor and starving. No more restrictive provider networks. No more insurance. All right. She keeps bringing up the provider networks. This must be tested and pulled. Because for me, I just go to my insurance website and find the doctor. I have Anthem. Everybody has Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, right? Like you, right. I've never not been able to go to my doctor since I was a teenager. Like I've been on several different insurance plans, including 10 years of my life with no insurance. In my 20s, like I've never been denied. Like she just really is hammering this network thing, and this must just pull. Like people just must be really pissed off about this. But I've never had an issue with it. Like when I found my therapist, I just went to Anthem's website and found the doctor I needed. So
there are occasions where you can see a doctor like you've known him for years that's just not in your network. It's rare. In here in Indiana, because technically Indiana, still technically a small area. But if you're like a larger town, it's probably a little bit more competitive. So
this is
in an area like Boston.
I don't know about your grandparents, but my grandparents are like, we like Dr. Sheely and we'll only go to Dr. Sheely, and I don't care what the government and Medicaid says, we're going to Dr. Sheely. Like this must be old people. Boomers. Yeah.
Okay, boomer.
Everybody gets the doctors and treatments they need. No more restrictive provider networks. No more insurance companies denying coverage for prescribed treatments. And no more going broke over medical bills. You'll just bankrupt the whole country. The $11 trillion, I'm trying so hard to keep it in, but I just – this is a libertarian podcast talking about socialized medicine. What if you expected fair and balanced, you're the idiot. The $11 trillion in household insurance – and out-of-pocket expenses projected under our current system goes right back into the pockets of America's working people. And we make up the difference with targeted spending cuts, new taxes on giant corporations and the richest 1% of Americans, and by cracking down on tax evasion and fraud. Not one penny in middle-class taxes it will increase. That is an absolute fantasy, as we will see probably in next week's episode.
Aren't these same Democrats the one who are touting the fact that the tariffs that Trump has applied onto China are a tax that we pay? Do they not make this connection, which is true? Don't get me wrong, but the same thing applies here.
Well, the crazy part is, as we'll touch on this later, what they're basically going to do is it's not called a tax, and she's claiming it's not a tax. It's a contribution. So, like, for instance, the way that most insurance works after, I believe, the HMO Act in the 70s under Nixon, it's employer-based, where if you took everybody off of the employer-based insurance, like, for instance, I work for a company. I have no idea the numbers, so I'm going to make it up. Let's say the 20 people I work with are on one plan through my boss. Mm-hmm. You let go of those 20 people, you get rid of insurance and based employer and based insurance, those 20 people become consumers and start shopping for individual plans. Well, right now, your employer basically pays your insurance. Most of you, if you have employer based insurance, let's say you get a salary of $50,000, but you get full benefits. You're costing your employer $90,000 to $100,000 maybe, depending on how much they contribute to all those different benefits packages. What you make in your annual salary is not what you cost your employer. And so what she wants to do is something called an employer contribution, not a tax, but she wants to basically create another tax on businesses over 50 employees,
another cost to the business for hiring.
Right. So instead of you getting, let's say you, in that example, you cost, you get $50,000 and your insurance and benefits cost your employer 30. Instead of them not having to pay that 30 and you getting a majority of that money, probably in your paycheck, that $30,000 is now going to be taxed and sent to the government for your health insurance program. So, and this is just the early estimates. This is just a projection. So what your employer is probably going to end up having to pay is going to be far, far greater. And so it probably will end up costing you some of that $50,000 in salary because they're going to start taxing. And what they will do is it's basically a headcount tax. And so if you are a company that was responsible and nice and provided insurance for your employees, you're going to pay those taxes. If you were not doing that like Walmart, you're not going to pay those taxes. So you've now incentivized people to, in the year or two before this passes, completely cancel all plans and flood the public market so companies won't have to pay those new taxes. Or you're going to incentivize corporations to set up a bunch of shell corporations that then pay for insurance so they're not taxed with it, and it'll be dumped off onto other people. So you already see in just the beginning stages of her plan, the gaming of the system that people will actually do and how it is going to actually tax employees. Because if you look at the capital gains cut, why is the economy so good right now? People have the ability to hire because they have more capital. So unemployment is low. If you add another hundreds of thousands of dollars, several percentage points of taxes, you raise basically, I think I read that it was going to be 37%. Capital gains right now is 25%. It's going to go up to 37% under this plan. You will have effectively cut off all foreign investment in the United States. You will have people fired across the board for a myriad of reasons, but mainly they can't afford it. And then that head tax, let's say you have 20 employees and every person cost you $30,000 to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they're going to do is they're just going to say, well, we need to shed jobs, so we're going to fire the lowest income employees first mm-hmm. to save that $30,000 head tax a year. And so what you're going to do is the very people that you are trying to craft a plan for, you're going to hurt because you're going to get those people fired first, much like the minimum wage proposals that we often see. So, you know, it will end up being not just a tax on the middle classes, but the lowest classes, the lowest income classes specifically, which in turn only increases drug sales and the opioid problem. When people are out of work, things are not good.
And jail population absolutely go up because people will go steal. And this was all figured out back with HR 25, the fair tax, right? So they figured out that everything that we buy right now, every product, every service, because of the payroll taxes and the corporate taxes and all the taxes that are on businesses and everything else, they're passing that on down to this through the chain of all the different hops that go through there, and it ends up the consumer paying 30%. 30% of everything you pay right now is a tax that you don't see. It's a hidden right. tax. Same thing is going to happen here.
Yeah. So
and it's going to it's going to also drive to get companies to just stop hiring. You're just going to have a big major corporation where the core group is going to work for the actual corporation, and many, many temps.
Oh yeah, there's going to be a lot of contracting going on.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So no middle class tax increases. The $11 trillion in household expenses back in the pockets of American families. That's substantially larger than the largest tax cut in American history. And so what they're claiming is that $11 trillion in medical savings will be saved, but you're going to pay. It effectively turns out that it's about $326,000 per American for this plan. If you don't think that you're going to suffer some consequence, you just can't slow the economy growth. You can't decrease the economy by 10 to 20% and not expect it to affect every American. It's insane.
Well, you can't tax the middle class if you destroy the middle class.
That's
because
exactly
there's no
right.
middle class jobs.
Right. So let's go on to the cost of Medicare for all. Now, she's asked the top experts to consider the long-term cost of her plan to implement Medicare for all over 10 years. Donald Berwick, one of the nation's top experts in the healthcare system improvement, who ran the Medicare and Medicaid programs under Obama, and Simon Johnson, the former chief economist at the IMF and a professor at MIT. Their analysis begins with the assumption of a recent study by the Urban Institute and then examines how the cost estimate would change as certain new key policy choices are applied. These experts conclude that her plan would slightly reduce the projected amount of money that the U.S. would otherwise spend on healthcare over the next 10 years while covering everyone and giving them the vastly better coverage. So she wants to reduce insurer administrative costs. This is, I think, the most unironically funny part of this. She wants to reduce insurer administrative costs by basically putting them out of business. Incredibly, insurance companies spend a whopping $350 billion on administration costs annually, and then in turn push huge additional administration costs onto hospitals, doctors, and millions of other healthcare professionals in the form of complex billing, and then in turn drive up costs incurred by employers as they attempt to navigate the complexity of providing their employees with insurance. So Elizabeth Warren is mad at healthcare companies and employers and insurance companies for spending so much on administrative costs.
Mm-hmm.
Would anyone want to venture a guess why they spend so much damn time on administrative costs?
I'm going to assume because they're greedy capitalists, right? And the only way they can take more money from their customers is to make paperwork. You're right. This episode is going to be bad for people who can't get sarcasm.
Yeah.
It's a jobs program, right?
Right. For intersectional gender non-binary people. The reason they spend so much damn money is compliance because of government regulation.
What's that word, HIPAA? Have anybody ever heard of that?
I love HIPAA. HIPAA's great. HIPAA.
Yeah. How many times have I signed a HIPAA form in the past 2 years? Right. I've been going to a lot of doctor's offices over the past 7 years for a variety of reasons. And there's a lot of paperwork that we have to fill out, and it gets a little annoying.
And it's just boomers that make this, you know.
Well, and the worst part is that all your records are supposed to be digital now, so they should have digital copies of all that stuff already.
Yeah.
In my record, that should be passed around to all the different doctors. I shouldn't have to fill out a packet of paper every time I go to see a different
doctor. No, Google's been secretly collecting that. It's on its way.
And just call the CIA and let them
How would you want them to transfer that information? Because a lot of those people would probably try to fax it.
How can you fax a stick, right? A USB stick?
Oh, they'll try. You know, you've seen people try. It's not. I'm gonna fax you the hard drive.
Where do I stick it? Oh man. It's just amazing because, like I said, I've spent a lot of time in the healthcare industry over the past 7 years, and it's fun. The fun thing is though, I mean. The doctors have been wonderful and great, but they even are exasperated. You can tell when they have to do, we got this paperwork. We can't give you this medicine because I had a doctor with my wife's issues that was, she's having to fight the insurance company because she prescribed this, like these two or three drugs. And they're like, well, we won't cover those three together. You only have two or one. And they're fighting over it. She's like, I'm the doctor. I'm the one determining this. Right. And then they can't give her pain medicine after she lost part of her foot because, well, the opioid crisis and the government says we can't do that now.
Right.
So the government is determining whether or not the doctor, and that we said this before when the whole Obamacare thing came around, and I said this back when Hillary Clinton was trying to do the same thing back in the 90s, that as soon as you let the government involved into the medical industry, they're going to try to make decisions for you. And I don't want the government, which is in effect everybody else who doesn't know anything about me in my life, telling me how to handle my health care.
Right.
That should be my decision with my doctor. Everybody else can just screw off.
Yikes.
Sorry.
No. I was yikesing something else. Just
that Reinhold.
Yeah. Medicare for All will save money by bringing down the staggering administrative costs for insurers in our current system by destroying the companies. As the experts I asked to evaluate my plan noted, private insurers had an administrative cost of 12% premiums collected in 2017, and while Medicare kept its administrative cost down to 2.3%. My plan will ensure that Medicare for All functions just as efficiently as traditional Medicare by setting net administrative spending at 2.3%. So, next, comprehensive payment reform. Under my approach, Medicare for All will sharply reduce administrative spending and reimburse physicians and other non-hospital providers at current Medicare rates. Now, does anybody who's ever interacted with any government agency within the sound of my voice truly believe that a government-run program, a bureaucracy that will control 20% of our economy, will sharply reduce administrative spending and reimburse physicians and other non-hospital providers in a timely manner? Anyone?
Show me the proof of that actually ever happening. And the only time
the number one cause of crime in Florida is Medicare fraud, by the way.
Oh, and you always get pointed to this too on the people on the left say, well, look at the low cost of Medicare, the low administrative cost of Medicare. It's lower than regular insurance. Like, yeah, because you're fudging the numbers because it's the government program because they're borrowing money. They don't have to, and they're using force that you, of course you can manipulate and say whatever you want. But when you look at what really happens is the people who are getting screwed too much by Medicare, they just quit taking Medicare.
Right.
Yeah. They're going to be doing it under the table. We're going to have, just like we have with the drug war and prohibition and everything else, is when you eliminate, you try to over-regulate something, it's just going to go a black market, and good luck.
Yeah. So her plan will also rebalance rates in a budget-neutral way that increase reimbursements for primary care providers and lower reimbursements for overpaid specialties. So she's, let me rephrase that in a non-Reedy way. She's going to rebalance rates that increase reimbursements for primary care providers, but lower reimbursements for quote unquote overpaid specialties. So AKA, if you want to take that extra 2 or 3 years of college and spend that extra money to try and become a person that makes $2 to $3 million because you're an anesthesiologist, the most deadly and dangerous position in medical care, or a heart surgeon, she's going to make sure you don't get paid as much. So what incentive would those people have who why not just become a lawyer? Why deal with all this bullshit? Why would anybody who wants to become a doctor deal with any of this?
Become a politician. That's where the money's at.
Right. Well, private yeah, she's the richest candidate in the race other than Donald Trump. She's worth $12 million, by the way. She's talking about herself when she talks about the 1%. So while private insurance companies pay higher tax, higher rates, this system would be expected to continue compensating providers at roughly the same overall rate they are currently receiving. Why? This is partially because providers will now get paid Medicare rates for their Medicaid patients, a substantial raise. But it's also because providers spend an enormous amount of time on billing and interacting with insurance companies that reduces their efficiency and takes away from time with patients. So all of this assumes that somehow the government plan, the government-operated system, will be more efficient than what we have now, which is inefficient because of government. The Nonpartisan Institute of Medicine estimates that these wasted expenses account for I agree there are wasted expenses. Let's just end all this regulatory bullshit in medicine. Account for 13% of the revenue for physician practices. So 13% of your doctor's total revenue goes towards compliance with the government. It's what she's accidentally telling you. 8.5% for hospitals and 10% for other providers. So you're telling me costs could be 10% lower if we just got rid of all of the unnecessary bullshit that they have to go through? Together, the improved efficiency will save doctors time and money, helping significantly offset the revenue they will lose from getting rid of higher private insurance rates. Under my approach, Medicare for All will sharply reduce administrative spending and reimburse hospitals at an average of 110% of current Medicare rates. So if you've been with the government the whole time, we're going to bonus you for being good boys and girls. With an appropriate adjustment for rural hospitals, teaching hospitals, and other healthcare providers with challenging cost structures. Pretty soon you're going to see Methodist at 16th and Post turn into a rural hospital. There's a food desert around us. Help. In 2017, hospitals that treated Medicare patients were paid about 9.9% less than what it cost to care for that patient. The increase I am proposing under Medicare for All will cover hospitals' current costs of care, but hospital costs will also substantially decrease as a result of simpler administrative processes, lower prescription drug prices, and the end of bad debt from uncompensated care. Oh, she's going to just cancel off the debt, I think she's saying. And more patients with insurance seeking care. In my plan for rural America, for example, I've committed to creating a new designation under Medicare. I'm just going to kind of skip past this part because it's I don't want to get too dry here. But it's kind of all the same stuff. You can read more of that in the notes. Restoring healthcare competition is also exceedingly funny. So under Medicare for All, hospitals won't be able to force some patients to pay more because the hospital can't agree with their insurance company. Instead, because everyone has good insurance, providers will have to compete on better care and reduced wait times in order to attract more patients. Here's the problem. You can't have a market. If you have a market-based system, you have less wait times because there's more options. And there's more incentive for providers to get into the business, and so you have less lines, less queues. When you have no markets, you have longer lines. It's basic economics of supply and demand. And so the idea that she is telling you that we're going to increase competition and get lower wait times by reducing the market to zero and only having one provider pay for all of this stuff is just economically nonsense. She either is lying, which is certainly possible considering who she is as a human being, or she is just completely unaware of economics, which also may be. She may just be so prideful that she thinks that she can will this into existence.
There are economic there are economists like Robert Reich, for example, who base their economics on what they wish were the case, not observed reality.
Yes.
And that becomes the problem.
Right.
So they come up with these formulas and everything else, but it doesn't contort with what humans actually do. It eliminates the human element in all of this. Because when you open it up and say, okay, you can go to the doctor anytime you want, you get a sniffle. You're going to the doctor to make sure it's not anything. It's not Legionnaire's disease. You know, you got a little bit of the flu, right? So right now, because it costs to go do stuff, people will say, well, do I really think this is a thing that I need to go to the doctor for or not? And they'll hold back. Therefore, they can handle the load. You start giving everybody the green light to just head to the doctor anytime they want. It's not going to make lines any less long.
Right.
Yeah. Because resources are scarce and they have other uses. So if you make it all free, then you take away everything.
And meanwhile, you know that the doctors are going to be so well compensated. And the nurses and all these people in the industry are just going to get so much money that they're going to be a flood of new people wanting those jobs.
Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's what I want to do. Do it the general public. Yeah.
Go ahead.
The other thing is just like, but because it ignores a lot of the rational things that what most people actually need in healthcare. Most people don't need a doctor. We just need to let nurses do what they do best and free them up. You know,
that's what we've had such an increase in the nurse practitioner kind of sub level of like the doctor. Then they have the nurse practitioners and the nurses. So the nurse practitioners can do some of the work that the doctor does. And if you don't need, you know, something very specific, you know, very necessary to have a doctor look at, let the nurse practitioner take care of it. It costs a lot less. Everybody saves money. You go home happy.
Right. We carry a job for the nurse, you know, and if we're able to bring it down to a lot of things to a nurse's level, we can Walmart the dang thing. Walmart can have a nurse sitting there in line. You can sit there and check out.
Well, you can go now and get flu shots, right? There's lots of things you can go to a Walgreens or a CVS and get taken care of now. Mm-hmm. So what's wrong with that market providing what we have, what we need?
I can't wait until I go up to the store. They're offering the flu shots in the line as you wait to check out. It'd be great. It'd be awesome.
And then wait to self-checkout, right?
Yeah, self-check. That's a better use of that cashier's time to get my gift.
Enjoy your vaccination. Next stop,
mandatory. Mind control. There'll be people with guns making sure you do that.
All right, so I just tried to Google this Murray Rothbard quote, but I couldn't find it because I don't think he said gangsters. But basically, Murray Rothbard talks about how the government is basically two cartels fighting over control of your life, and they're all gangsters, and you shouldn't trust any of them, which is just so true. And this is why this is the most gangster shit in the entire thing until we get to the tax part. So we just said, basically, she says hospitals won't be able to force is wrong, as long as she's not the one doling it out, patients to pay more because of disputes. Everyone will have good insurance. Providers will have to compete on better care and reduced wait times. So think about this. She's basically arguing that, you know, here I've got St. Francis near me, Community South, Community East, Methodist, and IU. I've got about five hospitals around me right now. I couldn't tell you who's the best in terms of wait times. I couldn't tell you who's the best in terms of care. I couldn't tell you. Like, most of us are not that informed about that kind of stuff. But she's just assuming that you will be a better consumer once you get onto the government. So the competition, in her mind, she's restoring competition because these evil hospitals and insurance companies can't play games with you. And so my Anthem Insurance is the same at any one of these five hospitals, right? my Medicare insurance is going to be the same in any one of these five hospitals. So the idea that there would be competition between those five hospitals does not make it a market. This is like when Barack Obama gave us seven choices in the ACA and said it's competition. When George Bush limited drug pricing competition and called it a free market solution. Like, it's not the free market. It's not a market solution at all. She isn't creating any competition whatsoever. She's, in fact, deleting competition because there's only a monopoly on care here. And in reality, one or several of those five hospitals are going to go out of business or be completely short-staffed because no one will actually become. But she will make sure providers will have to compete on better care and reduced wait times. It's mandatory that you have shorter wait times, even though we've created the scenario. See, we've created the game, and then we're mad at how you play the rules, and so we can blame you. Really, what you get out of government and politicians like Elizabeth Warren is they're an abuse of X. They gaslight you. They create the games and the rules, and then when you don't follow through in the way that they like, they blame you for being the problem. So then she says, that's why I will appoint aggressive antitrust enforcers. Enforcers, the woman says, to the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission, and allow hospitals to voluntarily divest holdings. Okay. She's going to hire aggressive enforcers to allow hospitals to voluntarily divest holdings to restore competition to hospital markets. All right. This is so stupid. That phrase is so stupid. My brain hurts from reading it. It has force and voluntary and compliance all with it and free market competition. What? No wonder, like, I feel crazy. Like, I feel gaslit. She's every bit as much the authoritarian as Donald Trump is. Like, I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah. I got a plan for your libertarianism. We're just going to do it by force.
Right. That's why I will appoint aggressive antitrust enforcers to the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission and allow hospitals to voluntarily divest holdings to restore competition to hospital markets. I've also previously committed to strengthening FTC oversight over healthcare organizations, including nonprofit hospitals, to crack down on anti-competitive behavior. And I will direct my FTC to block all future hospital mergers unless the merging companies can prove to that the newly merged entity will maintain or improve care. So she is deciding what is anti-competitive behavior, and she is deciding what is a quality of care. She is making the decision on who can do what with their property. If you grew a healthcare business and want to merge with somebody else, it's up to her whether or not you did a good enough job and whether this makes sense for her wishes. This is the most authoritarian paragraph that I have read since reading 1984. I mean, this is insane. She truly believes that she has all the right answers, that she is going to take this plan to Congress. They're going to go, great idea. You know, all those lobbyists and healthcare industry workers that they had to hire because you people will not stop regulating us, I'm sure they'll just rubber stamp all this and you'll get to single-handedly create a healthcare system to the way that you think operates best. Just like the Consumer Protection Bureau, which I'll put in the show notes our episode on that, Harry. If you remember that episode, which was a couple years ago almost at this point, the Consumer Protection Bureau basically turned into a liberal slush fund where Elizabeth Warren's hand-selected cronies were cracking down on conservative-leaning bankers and hedge fund managers. And it was basically a corrupt organization that she had instituted in the Obama administration. And it was just a complete joke. It didn't protect consumers. It didn't protect you and me. It protected her and her friends from the opposite side of the aisle politically. Now, hilariously, Mick Mulvaney is in charge of it still.
Yeah. And this is what it, what she's trying to also do to medical. Yeah. The whole idea, like, if the, you know, World Health Organization deems your medication that you created as, you know, essential and you, there's not enough of it, we will deem that we can now make a generic of it. Thank you for your patent.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, no. But they completely, Harry, at one point during this, she says, your patent is worthless if I decide so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the best part about all of this.
Which I'm down for because patents are stupid. Keep going.
Right? All right, fuck you. Hold
on. No, you're
fine. Keep talking to me. But
the worst part about all this is that you don't, they haven't learned a thing from the election of Donald Trump.
At all.
Because here we have, and maybe not in the way you think that most people would say that phrase, but if you're going to put the government in charge of something, especially something this volatile in your life and making decisions for you and determining this and setting rules on that, that only works if that person is you and you're holy, wonderful, and you're the angel that you think you are. But what happens when Donald Trump gets into office? Somebody you despise who doesn't respect all of that and decides to change it or run it in a corrupt way or some other Democrat gets in and changes it, or, you know, there's never, you're never going to be in a position where someone terrible cannot get into government, because that's kind of the way the government works and the way politics works. So all you're doing is taking a program that has some issues and we like to fix and giving it to the people who are the least capable and most corrupt to run it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
George Bush built PRISM and the spying apparatus and then handed it over to the Obama administration, who probably used it to help spy on the Trump campaign. And then the Trump campaign, I'm sure at some point we will find out the Trump administration used the NSA and its spying apparatus. They probably can, because Obama, those people hate those people. But
you know, we know Obama was using the IRS to go after political opponents.
So the bigger you build the government, the more tools you're giving to the person that hates you.
Yeah. So, yeah, this, it's like as crazy as they went over his election and was just mind gobbed, just freaked out about it. I was just waiting for that aha moment where they would say, maybe we shouldn't give the president or we shouldn't give government this much power, because then one really corrupt individual could just screw us all.
The Democrats have gone the opposite way. They want to massively increase. I mean, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren are begging for more executive power, basically saying, fuck you. I'm going to do with the office whatever I want. Way more than Barack Obama ever did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like where's this moment of enlightenment going to come? I was just waiting for it. It never happened.
Well, Brian Hull, the president is like the country's dad. You've got to listen to dad.
Right.
Yeah, especially when dad's beating mom and drinking too much, right?
Now, beating mom, you mean the Statue of Liberty? Oh!
So I had a couple more pages that I wanted to do tonight, but I think we're kind of... I think it's a good stopping point.
We're sarcasmed out a little bit.
Yeah, like we got 17 more pages to do next week. So this may be a three-parter, my goodness. He did such a good job of the notes, but man. So yeah, that is the beginning. That is part one. There will be a part two, maybe a part three on this. I just think it's so rich and deep that the benefit of the Warren campaign is that she is actually putting to paper so much of this liberal thought that has been floating around for the last 10 years, and we get the ability to analyze it. So if you see anything on there about Medicare for All, send it our way, editor@WeAreLibertarians. Any final thoughts, Harry?
One, it is, remember the last time the government decided to touch anything really at all? I was just going to say
my heart,
medical, but everything the government touches is usually junk. And I'm proud of Elizabeth Warren for not trying to, you know, she fudged some of the numbers, but we are talking about speculative numbers of a system of gigantic piece of the economy that had no one really has any grasp of what it is, because it's a gigantic marketplace. So the idea that you can even think you can manipulate it with, you know, some magic wand or handle, it's, I'm impressed just the simple fact she put pen to paper and said that this is, if I was going to do it, this is how we do it.
Right.
I'm impressed because the one thing you, it's always hard to argue with any of those, like most, you know, quote unquote progressives is they won't put their, you know, they won't put their ideas on paper and say, well, that's not mine. That's not mine. I'm not that. Well, here you go. Thank you. Thank you. This is all I wanted. Tell me how you were going to do for this. Cool. Now I can debate this. I can tell you how this is wrong and this isn't going to work. Thank you. And that's what, that's why it's so hard to debate them. That's why, like, anyone you ever feel like it's hard to debate them, stop debating them and then just try to get specifics of what they're trying to debate. Put it down on paper.
Yeah. Yep. Reinhold?
Yeah, I just, like I said before, I've spent a lot of time in the medical industry as a consumer for the past 7 years, and it is clear that some of these people just don't really understand what is going on and what the issues are. They want to make political points. They want to score in some way, but they don't want to take the time to actually go out and learn and listen and find out what the real problems are. So it just gets to the point of why, you know, why are we listening to these people trying to do any of this stuff? And why would we give them the power to do it? And that's pretty much it. And just before I kick it over, I want to make sure to remind everybody to get on the Discord. Where Harry and I kind of spend a lot of time hanging out, and
thanks for the warning.
And you want to follow me on Facebook? It's Reinhold on Facebook, Reinhold on Twitter, and Reinhold Plays on Twitter on Twitch.
All right, I'm
doing actual plugs. I haven't done that in a year.
All right, yeah, please join the Facebook group too. It's all right there at WeAreLibertarians.com. Thanks everybody for watching. We will continue with part two next week. Harry will be out of town. Fear not, he will be back. Maybe Reinhold, you can come back next Tuesday. We'll do another Zoom. Yep. Maybe I can rope in the Empress and do that. So we will see you.
That'll be great.
We will see you next week. Thanks, everybody.